Hello, this is Chris Long with the fourth episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. Strange things are happening in paradise. Puller has come across a police investigation of two dead bodies that have washed up from the sea. Puller nodded at the blue tap. You call the ME yet? She'll be here as soon as she can, Puller nodded. It seemed that his 7 o'clock meeting with Timmons was going to be postponed. I won't ask you for details because I don't want you to get in trouble with Bullock. Thanks. Where's your partner? Landry looked uncomfortable. He ran into a little problem. Did he puke and pass out when he saw the body? She looked away, but something in her features told Puller he had nailed that one. I've got a lot of experience with bodies coming out of the ocean. Why, I thought you were Army, not Navy. Oh, you wouldn't believe what goes on in the infantry. And lots of Army bases are next to bodies of water. I doubt Chief Bullock would approve of that. I know he wouldn't, but I thought I'd offer anyway. And if you ever want to run anything by me, unofficially, of course, feel free. I appreciate that. We don't have a traditional plainclothes detective division. Uniforms do it all. If we get in over our heads, we can call in help from the county or the state police. Sounds like a plan. You've been busy following up on things with your aunt's death. A little. If you find out anything that shows it wasn't an accident, will you bring it to me? I will. And you won't play vigilante? I never go looking for trouble. But somehow it finds you. Sometimes. I'm staying over at a place called the Sierra. Not exactly a great part of town. It is if you can't afford the really great parts. And for the record, $80 a night is not exactly cheap in my mind, even with breakfast thrown in. What can I say? It's paradise. Can you tell me more about the area? Like what? I'm sure you have the typical problems, but do you have any gangs? Officially, no. In reality, yes. What do you mean, officially, no? Paradise is a tourist destination. Of the millions of people who come to the Panhandle every year, lots of them come to Paradise. So officially, we don't have a gang problem. Okay, so what does your unofficial gang problem consist of? An unusual hybrid. We don't have the typical ethnic and racial divides here. No Bloods and Crips versus Latino gangs versus skinheads. Meaning you have diversity in your gangs. Very commendable. Why do you ask? Did something happen? Nothing worth mentioning. Crime limited to the poorer areas? People crimes, yeah, for the most part. Gang on gang. But the property crimes leach into the higher dollar communities for obvious reasons. Go where the good stuff to steal is. Exactly. The really rich places around here have their own security. Either behind community walls with rent-a-cops or behind their own gates with professional types. I'm seeing a whole other side of paradise. Hey, this stuff happens where you have money bumping up against poverty. Meaning America, basically. Don't know about that. So who's assigned to investigate this? Chief Bullock is going to personally handle it. He knows the family. Is he good at investigative work? He's the chief. You didn't answer the question. I guess we'll find out. I guess we will. Chapter 23. Puller sat down on a beach chair and watched as Landry and another uniformed officer strung up yellow police tape around the scene using long metal poles driven in the sand to support it. What Puller expected to happen did occur about 20 minutes later. A Volvo pulled up and a woman got out. She was in her 50s with graying hair cut short, a white sleeveless blouse, a blue skirt that hit right below the knees, and sandals. She wore bifocals that rode on a chain. She carried a black medical bag. Louise Timmons, the medical examiner, had arrived. She looked harried and upset. She walked directly to the police tape and was admitted by Landry. Timmons ducked under the tape and marched to the blue top, where she was met by Bullock. After a brief conversation, Timmons slipped inside the makeshift enclosure. It would not be a pleasant sight or smell within such close, heated quarters, Puller knew. You just had to keep breathing, and pretty soon your sense of smell would fail, and fortunately so. By his watch, it was half an hour before Timmons reemerged into the sunlight. To Puller's eyes, she looked a little queasy and more than a little upset. He wondered if she might have known the deceased, if there was only one body in there. She spoke for some minutes to Bullock, who nodded and wrote things down on a spiral notepad. When Timmons cleared the tape and headed for her car, Puller approached. "Dr. Timmons." She looked up at him. She was only about 5'2", and thus had to crane her neck back some to fully take him in. "Yes?" "John Puller, we talked before." "Right, your aunt." She did not seem pleased to have encountered him here. "I meant to call you to say that I would be delayed when I found out about this, but time got away from me." "That's okay. We can reschedule. I know you weren't expecting this thing on the beach." He studied her more closely while she pulled her car keys from her purse. Up close, she looked pale, drawn, and jumpy. "No, I wasn't expecting it. I was totally floored by it, in fact." "Anyone you knew?" She looked at him sharply. "What makes you say that? You look more upset than is warranted by seeing a dead body, even one pulled out of the water. Looking at death is never easy. But you're a doctor and a medical examiner. You see it all the time under all conditions. And since this is an oceanside town, I doubt that's the first drowning victim you've seen. I really kind of talked to you about this." "I know, and I'd much prefer not to waste your time. Can we meet about my aunt?" She looked at her watch. "I'd be glad to buy you dinner if you have an appetite." "No food, but maybe a little ginger ale on my stomach might help." "Okay, the cafe we were going to meet at is a few blocks over. You want to walk or drive?" "Let's drive. My legs are a little wobbly right now." As they walked to their cars, Puller turned around and saw both Bullock and Landry watching them. The police chief looked pissed. Landry seemed merely curious. They drove separately to the cafe and found parking on the street. The place was crowded, but they were able to snag a table near the front. Timmons ordered a glass of ginger ale and Puller a Coke. It was after 7, and the temperature was still in the mid-80s, and the ocean breeze had fallen away. "Feels more like hell than paradise, doesn't it?" said Timmons after they had gotten their drinks. She took a long sip of her ginger ale and sat back, looking a bit better. "I take it you're a transplant here. Why do you say that? Your skin is too pale and you're not used to wearing sandals, which for women down here are probably a daily accessory." She glanced down at her feet where the sandal strap had made several red marks against her skin. "The longer you wear sandals, the more your skin will toughen up." "You're very observant. The army pays me to be. I'm from Minnesota originally. Moved down here about 6 months ago. My first summer here. Minnesota can get hot in the summer, but nothing like this." "So why'd you come down?" "My husband died. I'd never been out of state. I was tired of long winters. A doctor I'd met was selling his practice, and I've always had an interest in forensic pathology. When I found out the job also included being the district ME, I jumped on it. And the place being named Paradise probably didn't hurt. The brochures were very attractive." "So will you be heading back north?" "I doubt it. Place grows on you. June through August it gets crowded and the heat and humidity are pretty bad, but the rest of the year is quite nice. I could never take a walk in shorts in February in St. Paul." Paula leaned forward, officially ending the chit-chat session. "My aunt, you saw the body." "How do you know that?" "Kyle Brown over at Bailey's told me. We're friends. Local doctor and the funeral home in Florida get very close. Lots of my patients die. Old age catches up with everyone at some point. I saw the body." "And?" "And what?" "I checked you out, Agent Puller. I have some contacts at the Pentagon. My brother is in the Air Force. I was informed that you are absolutely terrific at what you do, and that tenacity doesn't come close to describing your intensity when you're on the hunt." Puller sat back, gauging the woman in a different light now. "There was a bruise on her right temple. I saw that. There was also a slight blood stain on the stone surrounded the fountain. So cause and effect, but what made her fall? Did she stumble, or did she have a heart attack or stroke, or did an aneurysm pop? None of the above. She was in remarkably good shape, at least internally. Heart, lungs, other organs disease-free. She had bad osteoporosis and a curved spine, but that was about it. She died from water in the lungs, asphyxiation, technically. So what made her fall? She was using a walker. The ground might have been slick from some of the water from the fountain falling there. She goes down, hits her head, becomes unconscious, and drowns in 24 inches of water. It happens. I wonder how often. Once is enough in this case. Nothing else suspicious on the body. No detective wounds, no ligature marks, no other bruising that would indicate someone had attacked her. Puller nodded. That corresponded to what he'd found. Talk screens? Won't be back for a while, but I saw no signs of poisoning, if that's where you're going. And there were no indications of abuse or alcohol or drugs. I think the most my aunt ever had was a glass of wine. At least that I remember. The post bore that out. As I said, except for the spinal issues, she was in remarkable shape for someone her age. She had quite a few years left to go. My aunt wrote a letter. In that letter, she was concerned about something in paradise. Any idea what she could have meant? What sort of concerns did she have? People not being who they seemed. Mysterious happenings at night. Like I said, I just got here 6 months ago. I don't know enough people to be aware if they are who they are or not. And mysterious happenings, if she counts parties of drunk guys and gals parading half-naked down the main strip at 2 a.m. as being mysterious, then she's got my vote. So nothing else you can tell me. Afraid not. I know it seems senseless, Agent Puller, but accidents do happen. Yeah, they do. But what Puller was thinking was, if it was an accident, why are people in Chrysler following me? He wasn't just spontaneously thinking this. He had just seen the car pass by the front of the cafe and stop near his Corvette. The window came down, and he was pretty sure he saw a flash. They had taken a picture. Before he could even think of racing after them, the Chrysler drove away. Agent Puller, is everything all right? Everything's cool. I hope I was able to allay your concerns about your aunt. I think my concerns are right where they should be. Chapter 24. As Puller was leaving the cafe, his phone buzzed. Puller. Mr. Puller, this is Griffin Mason. You called my office about your aunt. That's right. Can we meet tonight, or is it too late? I'm still at my office if you'd care to come by. You know the address? I'll be there in 20 minutes. Puller got in the Corvette and was at the lawyer's office 2 minutes early. It was in a former residential area where the homes had been turned into small businesses. It was 2 blocks off the water, and Puller assumed the land was worth more than the houses. But then again, maybe that applied to pretty much all the homes on this narrow strip of earth with bay water on the north side and warm gulf water to the south. A late model Infiniti coupe was parked in the concrete driveway. The front door was unlocked, and Puller walked into a small reception area. There was no one there. Puller assumed the hired help had long since departed. Mr. Mason, he called out. A door off the reception area opened, and a short, flabby man stood there. He had on gray pinstripe pants, braces to hold them up, although his ample belly probably needed no help to do that, and a white starched dress shirt with the sleeves rolled up. He had a short, graying beard, and his glasses were thick enough to be called Coke bottles. Mr. Puller. That's me. Please come in. They settled in Mason's office, which was comfortably furnished in leather and soft, dark woods. A bookshelf held a staggering number of weighty legal tomes, and file folders were stacked against walls and also covered his desk, where there was also a computer. Business looks good. Frankly, a trust and estates lawyer in Florida is a no-brainer from a business point of view. You don't have to be a brilliant attorney, you just have to be competent and have a pulse. The average age of my clientele is 76, and they keep coming. I've had to turn business away even after hiring an associate 2 years ago. I might have to hire a second lawyer if things keep going that way. Nice problems to have. Now about my aunt. Just as a legal technicality, could I see some ID, please? Puller pulled out his cred pack and showed Mason, who smiled and said, Your aunt spoke very highly of you. I hadn't seen her in a while. As soon as he finished the statement, he felt a pang of guilt. Well, it didn't diminish one iota her admiration for you and what you've accomplished. I'm just an army grunt. There are lots of us. Don't be modest, Agent Puller. I was never in the military, but my father was. World War II. Your aunt told me about the medals you've earned. Quite impressive. Puller wondered who had told his aunt about this. He didn't think it was his father. The old man just wasn't that into his son's lives. I tried to phone her when my father received a letter from her. No one answered. Then I discovered what had happened. I understand that my aunt had a caregiver, a Jane Ryan. I know Ms. Ryan. She's a very capable young woman. She has lots of clients in town. I look forward to meeting her. It was quite a shock to hear my aunt was dead. I know, it was very shocking to me as well. She had some physical problems, but she seemed very strong mentally. I thought she would live to be 100. You say she wrote a letter to your father, is that why you came? Yes, I thought it was time to pay her a visit. Did she have a will? Yes, she did, and I can tell you the contents. I refreshed my memory on them after I got your call. What are they? With the exception of a few minor bequests, she left everything to you. Pulla stared at the man. This was not something he had ever expected. To me and not my father? Not unless your father is Chief Warrant Officer John Pulla, Jr. No, he's a 3-star, retired. I'm the CWO. Then you get it all. You seem surprised. I am. Like I said, we hadn't been in contact for many years. I didn't even know she knew my current rank. It was very recent. She had no children, and her husband had passed on. And as I said, she thought very highly of you, was quite proud, called you the son she wished she'd had. The statement hit Pulla like a sucker punch to his kidneys. Okay, he said slowly, for he could think of nothing else to say. She had various investments in her home. The real estate will need to go through probate. There are numerous legal steps that must be gone through before you will receive the property. It could take up to a year, I'm afraid. That's not a problem. I don't need the money. I have inventory lists of her personal possessions. I do that for all my clients. That way you'll know exactly what you'll be getting. I can give you a copy now if you'd like. Pulla shrugged but nodded, and Mason produced several sheets of paper stapled together, which he handed to Pulla. They're very recent. We had just gone over her estate about a month ago. Did she give any reason why? No, but we usually met about once a year to make sure everything was up to date and that she didn't want to make any changes in her estate planning. I see. Pulla ran his gaze over the pages. There were things like books, pictures, jewelry, some humble collectibles, and the like on there. He didn't really want any of it. I'll take your contact info from you and keep you posted as we progress through the stages. Once the house is titled in your name, you can do with it what you want. Live in it, rent it, or sell it. Fine, whatever. And her stock, bank, and bond portfolios were fairly substantial. She made some good investments over the years. I have records on all of that as well. Okay. But then you don't strike me as the sort to whom any of that much matters. I've never owned a home, and I'm not sure I know what a stock or bond looks like. That's actually refreshing. Most heirs I deal with want it all, and the sooner the better. When was the last time you talked to my aunt? Mason sat back and clasped his hands behind his head, revealing sweat patches under his arms. Although the room was cool, let me think. Thursday of last week, I suppose, she called me. How did she sound? Sound? She sounded normal. What was the call about? Just routine matters. She had a capital gains question she needed an answer for. So nothing that was bothering her. Not that I was aware of. Pulla had interviewed thousands of people over the years. Some were telling the truth, most had been lying. Liars gave telltale signs, breathing sped up just a bit. Eye contact was lost, arms retreated to the torso and clenched, like the formation of a little cocoon to hide the false statement, or at least the bearer thereof. A good interviewer could spot the liar nearly 90% of the time. Based on that, Pulla was pretty sure that Mason had just lied to him, but he didn't know to what degree. Pulla said nothing. He was waiting for Mason to ask the question that he should have already asked if he had been telling the truth. Do you think your aunt was worried about something? Pulla didn't answer right away. He was thinking about one of his aunt's statements. People not being what they seemed. He wondered if Griffin Mason fit into that category, and he wished he had not shared the contents of his aunt's letter with the police. But he couldn't change that now. I don't know. Like I said, I hadn't really communicated with her over the years. Mason studied him closely and then shrugged. Accidents happen, I know, but it doesn't make it any easier to accept someone passing. But you can take some solace in the fact that Betsy thought so highly of you that she would leave you all her property. Would you happen to have a key to her house and a copy of the will for me to take? Actually, I do. Betsy entrusted a set of keys to me when she had surgery a while back. I tried to give them back, but she insisted that I keep them. Mason opened a drawer, took out a silver lockbox, opened it, rummaged through some keys in there, and pulled out a set of two. front and rear doors. Give me a minute to make a copy of the will. He ran the pages through a copier that was set against one wall of his office, then handed the still warm pages to Pullo. Pullo stood and slipped a card out of his pocket. Here's my contact info for down the road. Mason took the card. Are you going over to the house now? No, in the morning. Will you be staying in Paradise long? I don't know. I guess once you get to Paradise, it's hard to leave, right? He walked out. Chapter 25. Pullo parked his Corvette about a block down from the house and walked the rest of the way. Despite what he had told Mason, he had decided to check out his aunt's place now. He kept a lookout for police cruisers, even armed with keys in his aunt's last will and testament. He wouldn't put it past Hooper to bust his balls if he got the slightest chance. He walked up the driveway and glanced over at Cookie's house. It was dark now, and he envisioned the young'un partying into the wee hours in Paradise. He thought he heard Sadie yapping from inside the house, but kept walking. The yapping made Pullo start missing AWOL, his cat. He used the key to open his aunt's front door, went inside, and closed the door behind him. The house was dark. He didn't want to arouse suspicion by turning out on any interior lights, so he pulled his penlight from his pocket and started moving around. He had the interior of the place pretty much memorized from his earlier visit. He walked through the kitchen and entered his aunt's bedroom. The bed was made. She had not gone to sleep that night, obviously. She had gone into the backyard, either voluntarily or not, and there her life had ended. A nightstand next to the bed was filled with books. His aunt had been a reader when Pullo had known her all those years ago, and she had obviously kept up the habit. He scanned the titles with his light, mostly mysteries and thrillers. His aunt did not strike him as the love story type. If she was going to cry, it would be for a legitimate reason as opposed to a manufactured one. Pullo's light skimmed over the top of a nightstand, and then she came back to it. He risked turning on a light because he wanted to get a clearer view. With the table lamp turned on, he leaned down and saw that his first impression had been right. A small rectangular shape with a slight dust pattern around its edges. He picked up a Robert Crace paperback from the shelf below and laid it on the rectangle. It didn't fit, too small. He tried a Sue Grafton hardback, too big. He opened the drawer and saw a small black journal inside. He lifted it out, opened it. The pages were blank. He placed the journal down on the rectangle, a perfect fit. There must have been another journal, and it seemed to be missing, and something told Pullo that that journal would not have blank pages. They'd murdered his aunt and taken her journal because of something that was in it. Perhaps it would elaborate on what had been in her letter. People who were not what they seemed. Mysterious happenings in the night. Things that just did not seem right. He put the black journal back, switched off the light, and left the room. He took a few minutes to check the bedrooms upstairs, but found nothing of interest or help with his investigation. One closet was full of old clothes. Some were men's pants and shirts that had presumably belonged to his Uncle Lloyd. The other closets were filled with empty hangers, old vacuums, boxes full of musty sheets and comforters, and the odds and ends that folks collected over a long life. On a shelf at the back of the closet, he found several boxes. One was filled with jewelry that even to Pullo's inexperienced eye looked valuable. He went through the box methodically. There was also a collector's book with old coins inserted in it. These looked valuable, too. He wondered how long she had had all of this. He walked back downstairs through the kitchen and into the garage. The Camry sat there looking polished and ready to go, unaware that its owner would not be coming back for another ride. Pullo scanned the exterior of the car with his light, looking for damage or unusual marks, but he saw none. The car looked to be in reasonable shape. He calculated that it was about 5 or 6 years old. His aunt might have bought it before she had developed all of the issues with her spine. He leaned up against the wall and started contemplating things, trying to fill in holes in his aunt's recent actions. He was primarily thinking that if his aunt had seen something that had caused her death, it was either in the neighborhood or elsewhere. If elsewhere, she had had to get there somehow. And even though Cookie didn't think that Betsy drove anymore, he was often gone at night and wouldn't know if she only took her car out after dark. He opened the driver's side door and sat down in the front seat. He noted that, though tight for him, the seat was set back far enough for a tall woman. Then he saw the special devices that had been fitted onto the car. There were controls set within arm's reach to work both the brake and gas pedal, so his aunt could have driven this car despite her infirmities. He noted the sticker on the upper left side of the windshield. It was from a lube shop in Paradise. It listed the next date for service and the mileage the car should reach by that time. The date was from exactly 30 days ago. Puller looked at the mileage listed and then shined his light on the dashboard. He did a quick calculation and also factored in his aunt's death. In the roughly 26 days she could have driven in the car had gone an average of 10 miles a day, he thought rapidly. Could his aunt, with all of her back issues, have driven hundreds of miles at a stretch? It was doubtful. But could she have driven shorter distance? That was more likely. What if she had driven the same distance every day? 10 miles a day, in fact. That sounded doable, even with her back problems. So 5 out and 5 back, and at least gave Puller something to go on. Something to check when there was so much that wasn't clear. He could do that route on all points of the compass and see where he ended up. The next moment, Puller quickly climbed out of the car and softly closed the door. He extinguished his light and pulled his M11. Someone had just come in the front door of the house. Puller went through the garage door back into the kitchen, making hardly any noise. The other person in the house was now not being nearly as quiet. That could be both good and problematic for him. He edged around the doorway leading into the family room. He heard squeaks from above. The person had to be upstairs. He wondered briefly if it could be the police, but surely they would have announced themselves. However, if it was Hooper, Puller might shortly find himself in a shootout with the hair-triggered cop. The last thing he needed right now was to be arrested for blowing away a police officer. Yet, if anyone was going to get shot tonight, he much preferred it not be him. His hand slipped to his trigger guard. When it moved to the trigger, he had to be prepared to fire. And he would. And then he saw the person come down the stairs. And his military cop voice roared, "Down on the floor, now or I will fire my weapon." The person did not get down on the floor. She screamed and ran. Chapter 26. She did not make it to the front door before Puller reached her. He wrenched her arm back, pulling her face to face with him. "Oh, my God, please don't hurt me. Don't hurt me," she pleaded. Puller let go of her arm, stepped back, but kept his M11 at a 45-degree angle, ready to aim it up at her if the necessity arose. He switched on a table lamp, partially illuminating the room. "Who the hell are you?" She was about 25, with blonde hair and a ponytail. She wore faded blue jean shorts cut high up on her thighs, a tight-fitting lime green T-shirt, and flip-flops with Corona printed on the straps. "I'm Jane Ryan. Who the hell are you?" Her tone and words had grown more defiant when it appeared that he was not going to shoot her, but her fearful gaze held on his gun, and she still seemed wobbly. "John Puller, CID agent with the Army." "Good God, you're Betsy's nephew. And you're her caregiver, or were her caregiver. How did you know that? I ask questions like I'm doing now. What are you doing here?" "I left some things in an upstairs bedroom, a jacket and some slacks. I thought I'd be back for them when I came to see Betsy again. But, of course, that didn't happen. I'm sorry if I frightened you." "It's okay. At least I know my heart is strong now. Otherwise, I would have dropped from a coronary." She was about 5'5" and in good shape. The definition in her legs and the extreme trimness of her frame made Puller deduce that she was a runner. "I'm really sorry about your aunt. She was a nice person. Do they know how she died?" "How did you find out?" "I came here on the day they found her body. I was actually coming to visit another client on this street. The police cars were here, and then hers arrived. I talked to one of the cops. He said Betsy had been found in the backyard dead. That's all I know. I thought maybe she had a heart attack or something. Her official cause of death was drowning." "Drowning? I thought they said she was in the backyard. Did she actually drown in the bathtub?" "No, in the fountain out back. But it's not that deep. Apparently she fell, hit her head, and slipped into the water unconscious." "Oh, my God, how awful is that?" "Well, if she was unconscious, she would have felt no pain or panic, but it's still not a pleasant way to go." "Who found her?" "Next door neighbor. Cookie? Yeah. I'm sure he's really broken up. They were good friends. It was funny. to see them together. He's short and she's tall. She reminded me of that lady from the Golden Girls TV show. I'd watched it on TV Land when I was a kid. Right, said Paula. She was her own person, and although sometimes she was hard to get along with, I admired her spunk. Yeah, spunk runs in the family. Cookie told me you help him, too. Oh, yeah, I've got a lot of clients in Paradise. Keeps me hopping. You a native? No, and I don't technically live in Paradise. I'm in Fort Walton Beach, which is nearby. I came down here about 5 years ago from New Jersey. The winters are a lot nicer, meaning warmer. I bet. How was my aunt before she died? She had the typical aches and pains associated with someone of that age. She was on meds. Again, no surprise there. She used a walker. She was tall. A lot taller than me, but her spine was curved. She had her good days and her bad ones, like all of us. Yeah, but she recently had a really bad day. Yeah, well, yeah. How were her spirits? Did she seem depressed, annoyed, worried? Not more than usual. I've been a caregiver for quite some time now, and I've found that older people's emotions can run the gamut during the day. They tend to be in higher spirits in the morning. As night approaches, they start to falter a bit. At least that's been my experience. Did she drive, or did you drive for her? I would run errands to the store, the pharmacy, stuff like that. In her car? No, I'd use my own. The company I work for doesn't allow us to drive our clients' cars. Insurance thing. So did she drive then? Not while I was here. Which was how often? 2-3 times a week. Every week? Usually, yes. And did you stay over every time? No, hardly ever. She didn't really require it. When would you leave? Around 9. So if she went out at night for a drive after you left, you wouldn't know about it. No, but why would she go out for a drive? I mean, where would she go? Asking the wrong person. I just got down here. Don't really know the lay of the land yet. But if she did drive around and went, say, 5 miles out and 5 miles back, where might that take her? Ryan mulled this over for a few moments. Well, if she went south, that would take her right into the Gulf. If she went north, it would take her into Chattahoochee Bay. This part of the Emerald Coast is fairly long, but pretty narrow, with water on both sides. East and west? West, that would come out around the jetty, although it's all back roads there. If she stayed on Highway 98, it would angle northwest and take her to Destin. And east, then you'd be heading towards Santa Rosa Beach, seaside, and then way past 5 miles, Panama City. Anything interesting along that way? Lots of beaches. The Emerald Coast stretches for about 100 miles. You've got Elgin Air Force Base to the west, and east of Panama City, there's Tyndall Air Force Base. Lots of military bases around here. Right. I guess you'd know that, being in the military. And there's Pensacola, where all the aviators go to learn to fly. And Hurlburt Field, although that's really part of Elgin. Air Force has its Special Operations Command there, among other things. You obviously know a lot more than I do. Probably not a lot. I'm Army. The Air Force operates at a higher altitude. Well, again, I'm sorry about your aunt. And I'm sorry for scaring you. I really appreciate everything you did for Betsy. He walked her to the door, turned on the outside door light so she could see better, and watched Ryan walk down the driveway to her car, a blue Ford Fiesta with a large dent in the passenger door. As she drove off, Paula saw a police cruiser coming down the road. He didn't manage to close the door in time, and he was aware that the exterior door light made him about as visible as a digital billboard. The cruiser did a hard left into the driveway, and the driver hit the rack lights. Paula stood there watching as Chief Bullock stepped out of the car and headed toward him, one hand on his sidearm, his gaze dead center on Puller. Chapter 27. Bullock stopped when he was within 5 feet of Paula, who had stepped out onto the front stoop. You want to tell me what the hell you're doing here, and then try to give me a reason why I shouldn't arrest your ass right now? Paula held up the keys to the house. Got these from my aunt's lawyer. He slipped the copy of the will out and held it up for Bullock. She left me the house. It's all in here. You can call the lawyer if you don't believe me or what the document says. Bullock lurched forward, snatched the will out of Puller's hand, and read it under the porch's exterior light. He folded up the will and handed it back to him. I'm no lawyer, but it looks like you got yourself a house. Of course, if your aunt was killed, I guess that gives you a first-class motive to kill her. Except that I wasn't in Florida when she died. And you can prove that? If I have to. And if I knew I was going to inherit the place, why would I come down here, kill her, and then show up here and get arrested so you'd know I was down here at all? Maybe you're stupid. You'll have to take that up with the army. I'll take it up with you any time I want, so long as you're in paradise. Can we call a truce here? If I rubbed you the wrong way, I apologize. It was not my intent. Bullock rocked back and forth on his heels, let out a loud exhale of air, and said, "Forget it. Much of my fault as anybody's. I tend to get the hair on the back of my neck up too quickly." "No problem. I can understand that. You still think your aunt's death wasn't an accident?" "I don't know. I've talked to the ME, and I saw her body. Nothing has jumped out at me." "But you're still not sure." "I guess you can never be sure. Maybe I'm looking for something that just isn't there. Folks do that sometimes. Look, I know you're busy. Whatever happened on the beach today looked pretty important. I'm going to head back to where I'm staying. Thanks for not arresting me." Bullock shook the hand and then said, "Yeah, it was pretty bad, what we found on the beach." Puller took this as an offer from Bullock to talk about the case. "Drowning? No, both shot in the head." "Both?" "A couple, actually. The Storrows, Nancy and Fred. Like you remembered hearing at the station. Well-known folks around here. Been here longer than me. They took walks on the beach every night. They did the other night and never came back." "Any witnesses? Clues?" "Bodies were pretty badly decomposed. Nobody has come forward saying they saw anything." "Motive, robbery." "Mr. Storrow had $20 in his pants and a gold wedding band on his finger. Mrs. Storrow's diamond ring was still on her finger." "They have any enemies?" "Not a one that I know." "They were retired. They grew up together in Fort Walton Beach. High school sweethearts. Moved to Paradise a long time ago. He owned a string of businesses, small stuff, gas station, subway shop, mobile phone store. He sold all of them quite some time ago, and he and the wife were spending their golden years in pretty comfortable style. And the couple who reported them missing and who were at the beach today, the Storrow's son Chuck and his wife Lynn. Not making any accusations, but any motive there? Son is a great banker here in town and makes a great living. Doesn't need a dime from his parents. They were very close. Played golf every weekend. Had parties at each other's homes. Genuine affection there. So maybe it was a random thing. Wrong place, wrong time. That's what I'm thinking. Can you tell from where the bodies washed ashore where they entered the water? Having some guys who are good with the tides and currents around here doing that for me might narrow down a place to search. We already have a time frame for when they left the house for a walk. I know I've got no jurisdiction in this, but if you want another pair of eyes to look over stuff while I'm down here, I'd be glad to. Okay, Pola, depending on how things go, I may take you up on that. You have a good evening. Glad we worked things out here. Yeah, me too. Bullock trudged back to his car and Pola closed and locked the front door, then walked to his car and headed off. He drove to the spot where the Storrow's body had washed ashore. Wrong place, wrong time, maybe, which meant they may have seen something or run into someone, and that had cost them their lives. Mysterious happenings in the night. He gauged the distance he had driven from his aunt's house. My house now, and what do I do with it? The distance was 2.2 miles. This was not where his aunt had driven to. Whether or not that meant the Storrow's murders were unconnected to what had happened to his aunt was not a question he could answer right now. I don't know enough. I may never know enough. He was out of his element. He had no power of investigation down here. His official duffel, with all the equipment he typically needed to solve crimes, was all the way back in Virginia. Then he had an idea. He picked up his phone and called USACIL, or the United States Army's Criminal Investigation Lab, at Fort Gillem, Georgia. He had a contact there, Kristen Craig, whom he had worked with on many cases. He knew the hour was late, and Georgia was actually an hour ahead of Paradise, but he also knew that Craig had often burned the midnight oil. Tonight proved to be one of those times. She answered on the second ring. He explained to her what he was doing and what he needed. She said, I have a shipment going out to Elgin tomorrow morning. I can put the duffel on the plane. You can drive up and get it around noon your time. You're a saint, Christian. Just remember to call and tell my boss that around review time. She gave him the necessary information to retrieve the duffel. Before ending the call, she said, are you ready? Really in a place called Paradise? I really am. I take it that the fact that you need your investigative duffel means the town is not living up to its name. Your deductive skills are exceeded only by your ability to work miracles. You keep talking sweet to me. We might have to get serious. Pulis slid the phone back into his pocket and put the Corvette in gear. His work was not over yet tonight, not by a long shot. Chapter 28. Pulla had already spotted the place before a Hertz rental outlet that stayed open until 11. He pulled to the curb and got out. It only took a few minutes before he had turned in the Corvette and driven off in a Chevy Tahoe. The man at the counter seemed surprised that Pulla would want to trade in the Vette for a glorified truck van, especially in a beach town, but he smiled and handed him the keys. Have a terrific time in Paradise, sir. Yeah, said Pulla. He went next to a beach clothing store and purchased a baseball cap that read Paradise is Forever. Sunglasses and sneakers, flip-flops or sandals were more typical of beach attire, but one could not run in flip-flops or sandals, at least not very far or very fast. He also purchased some T-shirts and cargo shorts with big pockets that could hold big things like weapons. He changed into the shorts, T-shirt, and sneakers in the dressing room, put the ball cap on, slipped the shades into a pocket along with his M1, and walked out. He was physically imposing enough that it would be hard to miss him in a crowd, but most people's observation skills were poor. Dressed the way he was now, he could probably walk right past white, black, and Latino, and they wouldn't even look at him twice. At least he had to hope for that. He parked two blocks from the Sierra, but on the same street. It was well past dark by now, but not quiet. There was a lot of activity around here at night, and not just on the beach. Cars gunning up and down the streets, people yelling, he heard footsteps running. Whether they were heading to trouble or away from it, he didn't know, and he didn't really care. Diego had said his casa, where he lived with his Abdullah, was down the street and to the left. Pulla checked his watch and then scanned the street. He figured that white, black, and Latino had all awoken by now, made sure their brains were still in their heads to the extent that they had any, and were now on the revenge path. He further speculated that they would have done some recon of their own and found out that he was staying at the Sierra and drove a flashy Corvette. Thus the transfer to the Tahoe. Plus the Tahoe had a lot more space and Pulla figured he was going to need it. His investigation duffel would be pretty big and the vet's trunk wasn't that large. They might have recruited more muscle to help them enact that revenge, seeing as how three of them were not enough, and they were now spooked and suffering from contusions. It might come to bullets this time instead of fists. But before he confronted that, Pulla wanted to check something else out. He walked down the street, slipping past the Sierra, and nearly ran into a boy coming the other way. Pulla caught him by the arm to keep him from falling. You okay? The small boy's face was all bunched up in anger. He cursed at Pulla. Can you tell me where Diego lives? He cursed at Pulla again, the expletives coming out in a mishmash of English and Spanish. Pulla slipped a $5 bill out of his pocket. You can either take this or a bar of soap in your mouth. The boy pointed down the street, the blue one on the second floor. Pulla gave the boy the fiver and he ran off. The blue one meant the little building with the blue awning. It seemed to be a rooming house composed of two stories and what looked to be about 8 rooms, 4 up, 4 down. There was a wraparound deck on the exterior of the building and Pulla made his way up the stairs. He knocked on one door, but there was no answer. He was about to knock on another one when the door opened and Diego stood there. He looked up at Pulla, and right away Pulla could tell something was wrong. What is it, Diego? There was movement over Diego's shoulder, and Pulla was able to answer his own question. Isabel was standing there with Mateo next to her. Her face was bruised, and so was Mateo's. Someone had used them for punching practice. Mateo was sniffling and coughing. Isabel said nothing. She just stared at Paula with unfriendly eyes. But Diego said, Isabella told me what happened. I wanted to thank you for helping her and Mateo. Are they your brother and sister? My cousins. We all live with our grandmother. Where is she? Working. At a restaurant on the water. The Clipper. She works in the kitchen. As a cook? No, as a cleaner. Who did that? Who do you think, said Isabel. I'm sorry, but I had to step in, Isabel. I couldn't let them do that to you. Why not? It's happened before. You're not a puta, reported Diego. Mateo began to cry. Maybe I am a puta, said Isabel. No, you're not, said Paula. It's not a road you want to go down. Oh, right. I'll just go to college and become a doctor or something. Why not? What planet do you live on? You are not a puta, Diego said again, and she looked away, gently stroking Mateo's head to make him stop crying. Did you see the car? Diego looked over at Isabel, who was watching them closely. He stepped outside and closed the door. What happened to your and Isabel's parents? Paula asked. One day they were here, and then the next day they weren't. They might have gone back to El Salvador. I do not know. Doesn't your grandmother know what happened? She does not say if she does. And your parents would just leave you all here? They must think this is better than to go back there. They wanted the best for us. Now I am the man of the house. I will take care of things. Okay, I like your guts, but you're still just a kid. Maybe I am a kid, but I found your car, and you said that there would be more money. Did I? But Paula had already pulled out a 20. Give me the details. Diego gave him the license plate number first. How'd you get that? It was covered up. The men, they have to eat, right? When they do, I take a rag and wipe the dirt off. Before they come back, I put the dirt back on. Describe them to me. Diego did so. Are you sure? Yes. Paula handed him the 20 bucks. Isabel and Mateo, did someone come here and hurt them? Not here, or I would have looked like they do, too, because I would have tried to stop them. Tell me about the man I knocked out. Are they part of a gang? They want to be, but they are so stupid that no one wants them. They run some drugs on their own, but nothing much. Then they hassle people and get money for that. They are scum. Do they have friends? Anyone here has friends, if they have the money to pay for them. As he said this, Diego carefully folded up the 20 and placed it in his pocket. Think they're waiting for me back at my place? I think you must be very careful. Thanks for your help. I just do it for the money. I admire your honesty. Don't trust anyone in paradise, mister, including me. At some point, Diego, you have to trust someone. You need any help, you can come to me. If you are still alive, mister, we will see. You can just call me Puller. Okay, Puller. Buenos Aires. Yeah, you too. Puller walked off. Part of him was thinking about having to deal with the Three Stooges again and possibly their paid help. But part of him was thinking about the descriptions that Diego had just given him of the two men in the Chrysler. Lean, fit, buzz cuts. They fit the description of men who had the same employer he did. The United States Military. Chapter 29. Puller walked to the Tahoe, climbed into the back, stretched out, and thought about what he had just learned. If the guys in the Chrysler were former military, then that changed the balance of things. They might very well see through his disguise and change rides. They might be able to fire at him faster than he could fire back, and if they were still in the military, he wondered why they would be here following him. If they weren't in the service, he wondered the very same thing. After what had happened to him in West Virginia, it was possible that the military had put a tail on him. He decided to see if that theory held any water. He called Kirsten Craig back. She must have recognized his number, because instead of hello, she said, miss me already? Always. Seriously, don't you ever sleep? Look who's talking. Yeah, but I heard what happened in West Virginia, not the official story, because there is no official story, but just scuttlebutt, stuff between the lines. I think you could probably write your own ticket right now, even take a vacation if you wanted to. I'm on vacation, well, sort of. I have my iPad ready to take down your next assignment, boss. Puller chuckled to himself. He got a kick out of the lady. He really did. If she weren't married, you might even have asked her out. I need a license plate rundown. Okay, not usually something I do, but I know people. Do you know people who can get it sooner rather than later? You know the drill. Somewhere in the world, there are DOD personnel awake and on the job, and there are two of them on this call. I'll turn it around as fast as I can. Now, can you tell me a little of what you're involved in? Why? Just in case you get killed and I have to explain my billable hours. Is it even related to the military? 5 minutes ago, I didn't think so. Now I'm not so sure. It all started when my aunt sent a letter saying things were not quite right in Paradise, Florida. Then the next thing I knew, she was dead under suspicious circumstances. Jesus, Puller, I'm sorry. Yeah, me too. Anyway, I got down here and things got even funkier. And the license plate? Two guys making my business, their business, by following me. And from their descriptions, they sound a lot like dudes who either wear or wore the uniform. I don't like the sound of this. Her voice had clearly changed. Gone was the playfulness, replaced with legitimate concern. Me either. Do you have any backup? Like I said, I'm on vacation. You need to stop taking vacations then and get back to work. Seriously, Paula, get somebody to watch your back. Good advice. I'll start looking. In the meantime, get me what you can. I'll pick up the duffel tomorrow as planned. Just make sure you get to tomorrow. I'll do my best. He clicked off, set his internal clock to wake up in 2 hours, and closed his eyes. His hand gripped the butt of his M11, and he knew it would take him 3 seconds to wake, aim, and fire at anyone trying to do him harm. If that wasn't fast enough, then he was dead. That's just how it went. At the end of 2 hours, he woke in the back seat of the Tahoe, refreshed and ready to go. It was 1 a.m. now, and he believed that the time was right for things to happen. Both military and cops like to strike at night. Targets were tired in their beds, with weapons often conveniently out of reach. Yet even stupid criminals could grasp the concept of coming for you in the dark. 10 minutes later, Puller's theory turned into a fact. White, black, Latino, and three of their best friends were heading down the street, marching with purpose. It seemed like they had worked out the optimal ratio at 6 to 1. To Puller, their math was a little fuzzy. But maybe his standards were higher. Actually, there was no maybe about it. His standards were higher. All the men's features were grim. White was perhaps the most grim-looking of all, largely because it seemed his mouth was wired shut. I must have hit him even harder than I thought I did. They passed the Tahoe without even a glance. On the battlefield, this negligence would have resulted in their immediate deaths. But this was Florida, and not Afghanistan. So Puller refrained from drilling them all in the back with rounds from his M1. He could see gun bumps under their shirts, front and rear. Two of them carried baseball bats, and another was clasping a metal bar. They were loaded for bear, geared for war, ready to kill. Of course, probably none of them knew what being in actual combat was like. Puller did. For those who had experienced combat, they never wanted to experience it again. It was not really a situation sane people tended to embrace. But Puller, who was sane, had embraced it countless times because he had signed up for the job. It had changed him completely and irreversibly. It had made him a killing machine. He could slaughter people in ways unimaginable to most folks. He debated whether to let the night pass without this encounter, but then decided it was best to get it over with. Otherwise, he would always be looking over his shoulder, and he didn't have time for that. He did make one phone call, relayed certain information to the person on the other end of the line, and clicked off. He waited 10 minutes and then got out of the Tahoe. It was time to go to work. Chapter 30. The stretch of beach was isolated and thus deserted. That was why he was here tonight. He had ridden a small scooter over. With his great size, he looked slightly ridiculous on the little machine, but he didn't care. Beat walking and the helmet hit his face. He stood near a dune and behind a palm tree and observed the sandy rim with a pair of night vision optics that had been in the welcome package he had received on arriving in Paradise. The ocean was vast and black, nearly impossible to distinguish from the sky above. The conditions were hazy and the featureless horizon blended with the water to seem like one solid mass. The sea captured his interest for good reason. What was coming tonight would definitely be arriving by water. He checked his watch. He had been given parameters of time, and that's all they were, parameters. He drew in a breath and scrunched up his face. The smell was foul and it apparently always was here. He looked at the sand with his optics. The Emerald Coast did not live up to its name. There would be no sun worshippers here during the day, and no one at night for any length of time unless they wore a gas mask. 40 minutes later, his patience was rewarded. It was a wink of white light, nothing more. He saw no red and no green. The boat was not using its running lights, which was highly illegal and highly dangerous under all nighttime marine conditions. But he could understand their reluctance to announce themselves in such a way. He knew it was not the same boat that had carried him to the abandoned oil platform. He had heard the gunfire. He had seen the men riddled with bullets, their bodies hurtling violently into the water. But it was another boat, though probably far larger than the one he had been on. It was one in a long string of such vessels carrying precious cargo from one place to another. And this place, this landing, this beach tonight, was just one more stop in that string. The ride forward from here would be by land, in a vehicle that was not built for the comfort of its passengers. Nothing about the trip was built for their comfort, but the trip itself would be far more humane than what would happen to them at the end of it. This concludes the fourth episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. Your reader has been Chris Long.